So it's a great pleasure to have Sri Raghu give the last seminar of this year. So Sri got his PhD at Princeton, then was a postdoc at Stanford. After that, briefly an assistant professor at Rice before moving to Stanford in 2011, and so he's been a professor there ever since. So Sri has really wide-ranging interests, one of which is this problem of the interplay of interactions and disorder. And so today he's going to tell us about some recent results of his in this area. So please, Sri, go ahead.
Okay, thank you very much for the invitation, Anton, and the other organizers, and for this opportunity for me to speak. So what am I going to talk about? The past is trivial, the future is uncertain. So what I decided to do is to talk about some work that's very much in the present stages of completion. It's not yet published. What I want to do is share with you some of our preliminary results in this area. And let's see. The work I'm going to be telling you about is done in collaboration with Josephine Yu, who's a graduate student at Stanford, and Hongchen Jiang, who is one of the, I would say, foremost experts on DMRG techniques applied to interesting problems in many body physics. So some of our preliminary results that I'm going to touch on here will be posted in the archive early next year. But this in and of itself is part of a larger program that's only in its inception. So there's lots of work that I hope to be able to do in the future in this area. Okay, so let me start by really presenting the motivation for why study this problem in the first place. And that's to do with the physics of local moments spins in disordered systems. So we start with the beginning of the story. If we think about non-interacting electrons, the seminal work of the Gang of Four taught us how to think about disorder effects on metallic states. We know, for instance, that in dimensions under most general circumstances, say ignoring spin orbit coupling, if we don't have interactions, if we're in dimensions greater than two, we can have metallic phases and metal insulator transitions. And in dimensions less than two, all states will be localized, all single particle states will be localized. And when you don't have interactions, this strongly localized regime driven by disorder, this phase of matter is known as an Anderson insulator. So what's an Anderson insulator? Everyone, I presume, knows this. It's got vanishing conductivity as the temperature goes to zero. So that's in keeping with it as an insulator. It's a paramagnet. It has exponential decay of spin correlations, exponential decay of density correlations. But it's also a compressible state because there's finite density of states. You can see this by looking at the heat capacity because there's a finite density of states. There's the usual arguments give rise to a finite heat capacity, a T-linear heat capacity, rather. And if you also look at the AC conductivity, because there are little resonant states that cause scattering that are like hydrogenic atoms, the AC conductivity is vanishing much more slowly than the DC conductivity as a function of temperature. When the frequency is much bigger than the temperature, the conductivity looks like omega squared log of d plus one omega, where d is in spatial dimensions. So what if you include repulsive interactions? So on the one hand, this looks like, you know, we think of insulators as stable phases of matter, but I think we all appreciate that the Anderson insulator is somewhat of a sick insulating phase in the sense that if you add any weak repulsive interactions, it's unstable to the formation of local moments. And the reason is, you know, unlike the Stoner threshold in metals, there's no kinetic energy to offset to form local moments. Here in the insulating state, we just have, without interactions, just some random landscape where we piled some charges. And if we switch on interactions among the charges, they can avoid one another better, via the Pauli principle by polarizing themselves partially. And so what you'll expect is the development for even small interactions, I think, of local moments. And so the ground state with U positive is totally different. It has different low energy physics than the ground state at, in the non-interacting limit. So you can ask, what's the fate of this, these local moments? Do they form a spin glass? Do they form random singlets? that's the sort of motivation, one theoretical motivation for the talk I'm giving here. Now, if we can, if we look at experiments, experiments themselves suggest that we should, you know, really be thinking about local moment physics. So the garden, the canonical system in which you observe metal insulator transition, say in three dimensions, is the disordered semiconductors. And if you, we know for the, from the, the Anderson approach to localization that in three dimensions, the band tails, all the states are localized. And so at, in the dilute limit, when you add dilute dopant concentration, you expect insulating behavior, but upon some critical density, they should cross the so-called mobility edge and go into the metallic region across a metal insulator transition. And what you see in experiments probing the spin physics, these are experiments done in the group of Subir Sachdev. No, I'm joking. This is Palanin et al. But Subir was involved in this when he was at Bell Labs. In fact, the title of the slide is taken from the title of his paper, Spin Dynamics of Nearly Localized Electrons. What you see is that, you know, so what these numbers are, 1.09 is the ratio of the density to the critical density at which you would have had a metal insulator transition and cross the mobility edge. So this is in the metallic regime. You see the spin susceptibility, which is enhanced relative to the Pauli susceptibility. This is in phosphorus doped silicon. That indicates that the local moment physics is quite important. There appears to be no saturation of this, no quenching of the local moments as you lower the temperature. Furthermore, in you could add different charges of dopants. You can add phosphorus and boron, the so-called compensated limit. You see the same physics, and it's strikingly much more deeply persists into the metallic phase. So this is 0.58 means the critical density is half that, sorry, the density is half roughly of what you would need to go into the metal, to cross the metal insulator transition. And so this is in the insulating phase, and these two curves are in the metallic phases. And again, you see the importance of local moment behavior deep inside the metallic phase. And so if you really thought about this in terms of the Anderson model, which has non-interacting electrons with disorder, since all thermodynamic singularities are absent in that theory, provided the density of states is finite, it really invites you to say you have to think about interactions. Okay. So there's two perspectives. Since we're talking about metal insulator transitions, you can think about this from the itinerant perspective, or you can think about this from the localized perspective. If you start from the itinerant perspective, what you want to think about is the diffusive motion of electrons in a disordered landscape. This diffusive motion slows down the fermions. The effects of interactions is more important. And what one finds if you study, for instance, a sigma model based on this diffusive saddle points, is that interaction effects give rise to a divergent interaction in the so-called triplet channel. This was done in pioneering work by Finkelstein in the early 80s. In three dimensions, applicable to, say, phosphorus doped silicon, it wasn't really clear how one understands this from this point of view. There's some works by Kirkpatrick and Belitz who identify who claim that this growing interaction in the triplet channel should be interpreted as a magnetic instability in three dimensions and also in two dimensions, according to Finkelstein as well. And this magnetic instability occurs well before any putative metal insulator transition. So it's not clear that this has anything to do with the metal insulator transition or the resulting insulating phase that would occur at stronger disorder. I'll just say in passing, just want to advertise some recent work that we did. If you study this problem in two dimensions, what we said was this divergent runaway flows in the triplet channel that was noted by Finkelstein can be understood in a somewhat better fashion by instead of starting with a clean Fermi liquid and looking at both disorder and interactions, what we can do is solve the problem first, that of interactions, and really flow far away from the clean Fermi liquid to some clean non-Fermi liquid, and then switch on disorder. And we were able to control the RG flows in a somewhat better fashion if we didn't have any runaway flows. What we did find is that there's a stable magnetic transition. By that I meant there's a fixed point corresponding to a magnetic transition where the conductivity becomes more and more larger, and the system looks more like a perfect conductor. But this, again, in 2D, I think has nothing to do with the metal insulator physics. So I bring all this up to say that the itinerant perspective definitely finds local moment physics, but their relationship to the metal insulator transition and the insulating phase in particular remains unclear, at least to me. You can then take an alternate and somewhat complementary viewpoint, which was done by Bott and Lee. And the idea is really to say, let's study the physics deep inside the insulating phase. And this is, you know, the seminal work in which the concept of random singlets were really explicitly studied, following up on work of Dasgupta and Ma and others. And what they did was they said, if you think about the phosphorus dope silicon problem, if you have a light concentration of dopants, you should be deep inside the insulating phase. The tunneling between dopants is exponentially small. You should really be thinking about them as free spins. Their effective interaction should be antiferromagnetic. But since we're in a random, then we can place the dopants anywhere we want, the effective antiferromagnetic exchange can be arbitrarily broadly distributed. And using such broad distributions, you find that as you lower the temperature, you form singlets at larger and larger distances. And that's an explanation that they put forward for some of the thermodynamic singularities for starting from the insulating phase. Later on, there's another nice paper with an even nicer title by Bott and Fisher called Absence of Spin Diffusion in Most Random Lattices. And what they argued was that when you think about this problem of faraway separated random singlets, you can push this picture even into the metallic phase, because the effective interactions between the local moments and the slightly nearly localized conduction electrons, diffusive electrons, is very weak because the Kondo coupling should be exponentially small. And that means that the moments will hardly be quenched even at very low temperatures. So the thermodynamic signatures, according to them, ought to persist down to exponentially low temperatures, at least very small temperatures. I'm not sure this is an accepted picture. It's a beautiful story, but it's a story that's worth thinking deeply about. So let me just pause by summarizing these different viewpoints. You can take an itinerant viewpoint, where in dimensions greater than one, you want to think about the so-called formal effective field theory of the nonlinear sigma model with interactions, the sort of theories that were pioneered in beautiful work by Finkelstein. You find flows to strong coupling, indicating some kind of magnetic instability independently of the metal insulator transition. By contrast, you can think of a local point of view, which was pioneered by Bott and Lee. And in this perspective, you want to think about random singlet formation deep inside the insulating state. Of course, we'd love to. So this local viewpoint, if you think about the experiments in phosphorus doped silicon, seem to be, to me at least, to be a better starting point to at least capture some of the thermodynamic signatures, singularities that are present in the experiments. But there's been no progress in marrying these two viewpoints, trying to marry together the local formations of deep inside the insulator of spins forming singlets and how they might be destabilized by interacting with the itinerant degrees of freedom. And of course, many people have worked on this. So the viewpoint I want to take in this talk, so I've brought up some profound questions. I'm not going to, of course, answer most of them. I'm going to only address one very specific issue, is how you can think of formation of these random singlets starting in the insulator, but not necessarily working with a spin system, but starting with a fermion system. So it seems to me that if you want to push this perspective of first starting with the insulator and then trying to destabilize it by Kondo effects, frustration, coupling to fermions, we ought to understand how the insulator emerges and in the context of some kind of Hubbard-like models. And that's what I'm going to be doing today in this talk. Okay, so what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to study the one-dimensional Hubbard model with disorder, both at and away from half filling. The techniques that are used are mainly numerical because we're starting with the insulator where there's very little analytic theory that one can do, although that might have to be, we might have to rethink that. But for this talk, it'll be mostly numerical. And what I want to say, that if you want to stop listening at this point, the key punchline of my talk is that you want to think of this insulating state that occurs at strong disorder. Even though all states are localized, it's not an Anderson insulator. What it is instead is more like a random singlet for a range of dopings and different types of disorder. Okay? Good. So let me start with the numerical studies in one dimension. Are there any questions so far? Okay. I don't have a watch, so if someone could tell me what the time is, that would be helpful.
I think we're only 18 minutes.
Don't worry. Yeah, so
we're 18 minutes in?
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. All right, so let me start with the numerical approach that we've taken so far. As I said, we want to study the one-dimensional Hubbard model with disorder. We'll have different types of disorder. We'll have a random bond disorder, so random bonds with nearest neighbor hoppings that are modulated, that are random, and a chemical potential that we can also take to be random. We can also vary the uniform potentials. And the random hoppings will be taken to have some numbers, delta t times this variable x sub I. X sub I are bond variables or site variables that are independently and identically distributed in this uniform distribution from minus one to one. So they're just some random numbers. And the strength of randomness is parameterized by delta t and delta mu. Okay. And what I'm going to also do is just for the sake of. Yeah, please.
Is the xi the same for delta t and delta mu?
Yeah, so xi is just a random number, but the prefactor delta t and delta mu tell you how strong the disorder is. And they can be, you know, total. They will vary these two parameters separately. Okay, just to isolate what each does separately.
I mean,
does that answer your question?
For fixed I, is xi for delta ti and xi for delta mu are the same number or different number?
So mu is associated with the sites and T is associated with the bonds, right? So it's not, they're not core. If you're asking, are they correlated with each other? The answer is no.
Okay. Thanks.
Sure. All right. So, and for the sake of just simplicity, we can of course vary the strength of the interactions, but you know, numerics takes a long time. So it's good to just have a simple pass through the phase diagram with just holding the interactions fixed. Okay, so now I want to tell you how one obtains. So the key that what we do is obtaining correlation functions, and how are we going to measure this? So we're going to work with a chain of length L with open boundary conditions, and all the pros doing DMRG, certainly, which I'm not one of them, but I know from Hong Chen, who is a pro, the way you measure correlations is you measure the correlations only in the inner half of the chain so as to minimize edge effects and so on. So we're going to make the measurements only in the inner L over 2 portion of the chain. So for example, here would be a system of length L equals 72, and I'm showing here the measurement of a spin-spin correlation function. And now, even within this half interior of the chain, there are three characteristic regions associated with the correlations, which I denote A, B, and C. Okay, region A is associated with short distance B behavior where typical correlations dominate the physics. Region C is one where the edge effects start to dominate, finite size effects start to dominate. And region B is where one sees the behavior at large distances, but also ones that are not dominated by edge effects. So this is something that's peculiar to the strong disorder limit of the problem, because as you might know, if you look at infinite randomness fixed points, one of the hallmarks that they share is the very different behavior of typical correlations vis-a-vis the averaged correlations. So the behavior of the typical correlations will be seen in short distance behavior of the measurements in the DMRG. And the asymptotic behavior associated with the fixed points will be seen in this region B. Now, there is a separate and internal and objective standard to designate how we make borders between, say, region A and B. That is, you can look at the density-density correlation function. In anticipating what I'm about to show you, you will expect those to be exponential because of Anderson localization. The exponential behavior might change as we change interactions relative to disorder, but we still expect exponentially attenuated density-density correlations. And so one way to make this boundary between A and B is to say that once the density-density correlations decay to some fixed fraction of their value of the origin, that's when we go from A to B. And doing that leads to a consistent story as well. Okay, so I just want to do away with these important caveats, because now I'm going to go on and talk about the results. Are there questions? Okay. All right, so let me start with half filling. Okay. If we look at the density-density correlations, the behavior looks very different if we talk about bond disorder or sight disorder. Okay. So when you have weak randomness, so when this delta T or delta mu are small compared to one, what you find is that the random hoppings at half filling always, in a semi-log plot, look like an exponential behavior of the density-density correlations look exponential in the presence of bond disorder. But the random hopping, the random potential seems to have two exponentials. You may not be convinced that this is an exponential, but I will show you more curves which show this. At weak disorder, there's a crossover from one type of exponential to another. And at strong disorder, there's a simple exponential behavior of the correlations. Okay, and if you look a little bit closer at that, I want to point out this difference between bond and sight disorder. So near half filling, again, if you change, let's start with sight disorder, the random potential. As you change the strength of the disorder, this crossover between two distinct exponentials occurs at smaller and smaller distances as you increase the disorder strength, and after a certain value of disorder, this is completely gone, resulting in a single type of exponential falloff of correlation. By contrast, with a random hopping, the exponential falloff of correlations is relatively independent of disorder. Okay, having stared at this for a little bit, we think we know how to understand this as follows. So we're on a bipartite lattice and we're at half filling. So we can think of this problem as the repulsive U Hubbard model can be mapped onto the attractive U Hubbard model. The random chemical potential maps onto random magnetic impurities. And so what we're really doing here, we can think of this as the S-wave superconductor. At weak disorder, the S-wave state has a spin gap, it's a singlet. So you expect exponential fall off of correlations. So this region here is interaction dominated. So the ground state being a singlet of the attractive U system is stable to disorder. But then as you increase the disorder, the magnetic disorder, you will eventually pair break and destroy the singlets. And for after a sufficiently strong disorder, you expect disorder-dominated falloff of correlations due to the pair breaking effect of magnetic impurities. Now, by contrast, if you look at random hoppings, and if you think again in terms of the attractive U-Hubbard model, the random hopping is sort of like a random bond disorder, time reversal invariant type disorder, which is relatively ineffective in destabilizing the system. So one of the points, so having understood the difference between site and bond disorder, we were at least more confident that what we were seeing in numerics is indicative of some physics.
Sure.
Yeah.
For the random hopping, for the random hopping, do you have an extra charge conjugation symmetry here?
There's particle hole symmetry.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And this is a highly non-generic symmetry and not something that I want to spend too much time on, but at least this is a benchmark. In fact, the reason we started looking at this was we were looking to find the random singlet. And if there's one place where you will find a random singlet is on the chain at half filling with just random hoppings, because random hoppings give rise to random J's, and you should see this infinite randomness fixed points.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for the question. So the other point I want to make is if you looked at charge correlations, the two types of disorder look rather different, but they look very similar. I want to show you when you look at the spin correlations. So let me first start with by saying that if you look at the spin-spin correlation function, it manifestly preserves SU2 symmetry as it should. So that's good news that the numerical simulations work the way they should. And this is not just upon disorder averaging, but even in each realization of disorder. Okay, so that's one thing that you can say about spin correlations. But if you look at this, and then within this proviso of how you assign different regions to make fittings of asymptotic behavior of correlations, what we noted was that the spin-spin correlations, unlike what you expect in an Anderson insulator, which has exponential falloff of correlations, the spin-spin correlations look like a power law. Okay, so for the case of hopping disorder at half filling, you can fit these, and we're currently obtaining systematic dependence on the length of the chains and averaging over more realizations at stronger disorder. But the preliminary finding is that this power law is approximately, you know, some number between one and two, closer to two, and both for the random hopping and the random potential. Okay. So this is the sort of thing you expect for the random singlet phase. Okay. So the random singlet phase, I should have put references here, I apologize. As I said, this was discussed by Bhatt and Lee, and Dasgupta, Ma, and Hu, but really the exploration of the asymptotic behavior of correlations and in terms of the fixed points was done in this seminal work by Daniel Fisher. And what you learn is if you look at the random singlet phase of matter, it's got singlet formation between spins at arbitrary distances. The probability distribution of the exchange couplings is some universal power law. And you expect the spin-spin correlations to be falling off as 1 over r to the 2d. And in one dimension, of course, that means 1 over r squared correlations. The susceptibility has a correction to Curie's law, the Curie behavior, due to the, so basically you can think of this as saying as you lower the temperature, you ask how many free spins are there still present that would form singlets at lower temperatures but haven't yet at the temperature where we're working. And so this is the ratio of free singlets, and each of those would, free spins, and each of those would contribute a 1 over t contribution to the susceptibility. This is to be contrasted in the clean case, where we know from the work of Luther, Peschel, and many others, the Heisenberg antiferromagnet has fall off of correlations 1 over r. So if you look at the half-filled results of the Hubbard model, you find that for the spin correlations, a crossover as you increase the disorder from the expectation value of the power laws associated with the clean Heisenberg antiferromagnet to the power laws expected with the fixed point of the random singlet phase of the infinite randomness fixed point. And this is true for random potentials and the random hopping, okay? that's one of the key results that I wanted to highlight so far. But what we really want to do is go away from half-filling. So if you consider a generic doping of holes, say again at the length 72, what we can look at again is, for the starting point, the density-density correlation function and the single particle green functions, both of which, so the yellow curve is, I should have labeled this is the clean system, and this orange curve is for the random hopping, and the blue curve is for the random potential. Sorry, the other way around. The blue curve is for the random hopping, and the orange curve is for the random potential. And what you see is that with randomness, at some fixed randomness, these correlations fall off exponentially. Again, the spin correlations at half filling, this is one particular realization, just say with a random potential, manifestly preserve the SU2 symmetry, even in every independent disorder realization. And if you look at the spin correlations again, this is for a particular value of delta mu equals 8 and delta t of 0.5. You find that, again, this curve may not be very convincing, but we are getting many, many more, realization, averaging over many realizations, and this is increasingly becoming the case, that the power laws are associated with certainly not with the clean Heisenberg antiferromagnet. There are some error bars which we're still obtaining for the random hopping and the random potential, but these power laws are again somewhat closer to somewhere between the random, the clean Heisenberg antiferromagnet and the infinite randomness fixed point. But we expect what seems to be happening is that this is creeping up as we average over more and more stronger disorder realizations closer towards 2. So if you look, this might be more convincing. If you look at the spin correlations with different differential variation of disorder, random potential and random hoppings, you see this clear crossover between the Heisenberg limit and the random singlet limit, even at 1/12 hole doping, okay? Both for the case of a random potential and for the case of random hopping. I should say, once you go away from half filling, these two systems should not be any different. You know, by symmetry, broken particle hole symmetry, the random hopping can generate the random potential and vice versa. So I think away from half filling, the system is governed by some generic behavior. And if you look at this curve and the ones that I've shown previously at half filling over here, there doesn't seem to be a huge qualitative difference between the behavior of spin correlations. Okay. Any questions?
Sorry, can I ask a question?
Yeah, so please.
At half filling, this random singlet, I can guess naively think of as each on each side you have one particle localized there and then they form the usual picture. So correct. Away from half filling, how pictorically, how do I think about it?
So I'll get to that towards the end. There's a very simple hand wavy picture that okay. that helps with all of this.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Thank you for the question, John. Okay, so again, I want to say, you know, in the beginning of my talk, I talked about the fate of these spins that you have in the Anderson insulator. Do they give rise to random singlet formation or a spin glass? Well, in 1D, I think almost definitely you're guaranteed to have a random singlet. But if you look at ladders, which we're hoping to start doing that soon, we should start to see deviations from this random singlet behavior. Maybe we should see a spin glass once you have frustrations and other types of interactions. But for now, let me just say, you can pretty much rule out the spin glass order just from looking at spin correlations in the system. The reason is because, as I alluded to it, the correlations have manifest SU2 symmetry. We can rule out the Ising spin glass and the XY spin glass just based on that. And furthermore, I think you can't have a Heisenberg spin glass in one dimension. So this pretty much rules out the spin glass phase. But moreover, I think the interactions, if they're predominantly antiferromagnetic, this is what you would expect. This was the intuition of Butt and Lee also, that if you have predominantly antiferromagnetic interactions with huge spread in their variation, you should begin to, you should see random singlet phases rather than spin glass phases. And at least in one dimensions, that's certainly being seen here as well.
Hi, Raghu, I had a question. What about the low energy density of states? Do you see, as you turn on the interactions, what do you see? Do you see a gap opening up?
A gap to...
In the density of states.
Yeah. Yeah, so we haven't looked at that with DMRG. Whoops. But I would expect... let me see if I can understand. I would expect what I'm about to show you later, I would expect that that's not going to happen. Or at least it's not going to be substantial, the physical arguments.
We had a very large U. So there was a, starting out, there was a Mott gap. And I was curious, how does that fill up as you turn on
the So I think I'm going to address that. What you'll see is that as you dope the system, there's, you know, spin charge separation, and then the dopants fill in the gap. But that quantitatively, I don't think I can answer that question right now. It's a good question.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Anything else? I see something in the chat message. The Mott gap is only at half filling. Okay, good. Yeah. Right, so
ask a quick question? The results that you're showing so far, you're saying that you're working on getting more samples. How many disorder averaging are you doing right now?
We're doing about 500 to 1,000 realizations of disorder. You know, I should actually say that I was, you know, with disorder, the DMRG works pretty well. Actually, it works really well. It has, you know, no convergence issues. And so we've been lucky with that. The only thing we have, the bottleneck, is averaging over samples just to make sure that, which, you know, that we're not under sampling, especially at stronger disorder. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. All right, so now let me move on to so what if I've told you, I've looked at the Hubbard model at and away from half filling and provided numerical evidence in support of the random singlet-like behavior of spin correlations. Okay, and I just want to highlight some previous, so what was done previously in this field. Of course, there's billions of, well, maybe not billions, but many, many papers looking at infinite randomness fixed points of spin systems, starting from the work of Bott and Lee themselves, all the way to Fisher, and now in the community of many body localization, looking at excited states. But in terms of starting with a model of electrons at and away from half filling, the work that I want to show in terms of previous studies is this work by these scientists whose names, unfortunately, I can't pronounce. But what they looked at was the Hubbard model, the Hubbard chain again, at half filling only, in the presence of a random hopping and random interactions. And they found that when you switched off the interactions, if you're at half filling on a bipartite lattice, you can map that onto the XX chain. So there's a random singlet phase associated with the XX chain. And then if you switch on interactions, it maps onto, at least the Hubbard model looks more and more like the Heisenberg antiferromagnet, so the XXX chain, that also has an infinite randomness fixed points. And they found both of those. I'm not sure how they actually managed to do the real space renormalization group starting with the Hubbard model. I haven't followed that field closely, but maybe one of you know. But these are the claims, and these are consistent with what we're saying. Okay. So now, what's the physics story that you could tell based on these numerical results? So that's the last part of my talk. I guess this is a somewhat shorter talk than that you're accustomed to. So here's what you can say. At large values of U over T, you can really appeal to, you know, the seminal work of Ogata and Shiba and many others who looked at the Bethe-Ansatz solution of the Hubbard model, the Hubbard chain with nearest neighbor hopping. Forget about disorder for the moment. And what you notice is that the wave function that Lieb wrote down in the limit as u over t goes to infinity, there's a raised hand here. Yeah, go ahead. Question?
Hi. Could you listen to me?
Sorry, I can't. Go ahead.
I want to know what is the difference between the solution and the result.
The solution and the result.
Okay, yes.
The solution of what and what result?
A solution of for example, differential equation.
Which differential equation? Sorry, I'm not entirely.
Take an example. Take any example.
Okay.
Some differential equation.
Some differential equation. Okay.
What is the difference between its solution and what is the difference between solution and the result? What is the meaning of solution?
Well, I'm not sure I really know. I mean, what you're getting at. So that sounds like a interesting philosophical question, but I.
Okay, it's philosophical. Philosophical. Okay.
Okay.
Let's postpone this till after the talk. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Okay.
Let's continue.
Yeah. How do we know we know anything? I don't know the answer to that. Okay. Okay. Let's go to large U over T. So this Lieb wave function factorizes, you know, the beta ansatz when you turn the beta ansatz crank in the limit of large interactions without, let's switch off disorder again on a nearest neighbor hopping problem. The wave function factorizes into a piece that only knows about the coordinates of the electrons independently of their spin. So in other words, it looks like a Slater, and it looks like a determinant. It's a Slater determinant of spinless electrons and a producted with the beta ansatz solution of the Heisenberg antiferromagnetic chain, where the spins are located at positions y1 through yn. Okay, so, and we also know that in this strong interaction limit, the exchange interactions between the spins of the Heisenberg, so this is spin charge separation, the effective coupling between the spins of the Heisenberg antiferromagnet occurs at order t over u. So at u equals infinity, the problem is infinitely degenerate. But at order t over u, that degeneracy is lifted. And the system has Heisenberg exchange. And that's why we get the beta ansatz solution there. But let's see. I can't see my screen. But the charges themselves remain free up to order t over u squared. So this is how I wish to answer Chong's question, the good question of how do we understand this picture away from half-filling. So what I want you to think about is start with this and now switch on the dirt, right? We have free spinless fermions producted it with the Heisenberg chain. And so that's a very simple picture that you can understand most of our results. Once you switch on disorder, the charge sector, since it's free, becomes an Anderson insulator. Okay. Moreover, with the spin sector, the randomness gives rise to a random exchange. So for instance, if you had random hoppings, Tijs are random variables, that results in a random antiferromagnetic coupling, which is just 4T squared over U. Furthermore, we can look at the effect of the random chemical potential on the Heisenberg exchange. And what you find, at least at leading order, if you look at a single site where you put in some variation in the chemical potential, or two sites, say mu I and mu j being nearest neighbors, and if you take their average, there's a shift in the Heisenberg exchange given by this. Okay, so long as the disorder is small compared to the interactions, you expect the antiferromagnetic exchanges to dominate, and in both instances, you expect that you flow to an infinite randomness fixed point in the spin sector. And this seems to be the way to understand our numerical results. Now, since there's spin charge decoupling in this limit, I want to make a conjecture. This is the statement that I can't back up based on the calculations I've done, but I want to make a conjecture that these holes that form, that are essentially free, are responsible for, say, variable range hopping conduction, the exponent can come from, say, it's 1/2 in one dimension, if you have phonons or even the Coulomb gap. But the correction to this expression will be of the order t over u squared once these holes start interacting. But since we also have the spin degrees of freedom, we'll have thermodynamic singularities coming from them. So this is a conjectural statement that seems to be what you have to conclude starting from the large U limit. Now, I'm done with my talk. Let me just say what we wish to do in the future. So I think what I've hopefully convinced you of is that this problem is interesting both from the theoretical perspective of what happens to Anderson insulators with interactions, and also from the experimental perspective of, you know, phosphorus doped silicon doped semiconductors in general. You know, we've made some preliminary passes looking at the Hubbard model at and away from half filling, and the punchline is that we found significant evidence for random singlet phases. So this is just the beginning. What we wish to do is looking at just in the chain itself, we want to look at, say, whether the RKKY effects in more dilute limit can give rise to sign changing exchange interactions. I'm somehow dubious that that will ever happen. But we can look at what we really want to do is couple the random singlet degrees of freedom to more itinerant degrees of freedom to somehow try to marry these two perspectives. So we can't do that in DMRG. Of course, it's all quasi one-dimensional, but we can look at crossovers by, say, looking at two-leg ladders, looking at the role of frustration to see whether we can find spin glass behavior. We want to look at the effect of Kondo exchange between the spins that want to form random singlets deep in the insulating phase, but then also want to form singlets with more itinerant degrees of freedom, and whether that has something to do with the destruction of the random singlet phase. And lastly, this perspective of large U over T coming from spin charge separation seems to suggest that if you try to have chains, an array of chains weakly coupled with one another, but within each the interactions are strong, maybe one can make statements about the fate of random singlet phases in the presence of disorder and so on. I'm not entirely sure, but there seems to be many, many things one can do. And if any of you have any suggestions, I'd be keen to hear them. Okay, so I'm done with my talk and I'm happy to take questions.
So thank you, Sri, for a very nice talk. So are there any questions?
Can I ask another one?
Yes.
Sri, so
should I stop sharing, or what would you like me to do?
I think we can keep the slides.
Okay.
Yeah. If I didn't get it wrong, you've mostly been talking about large U over T. Is that actually necessary, or is it just makes your numerics easier?
I think the latter. I think based on this physics argument that I gave about, you know, since there's, you know, you can gain the ground states can form spin poles, local moments even at weak coupling. I think large U is not needed. It just helps with the story. Now, as far as the experiments, if you want to think about phosphorus doped silicon for some reason, right? Mm-hmm. In particular, then I think the large U over T limit is the natural limit, right? Because these dopants are quite far away from one another in the insulator. You really want to think of them as being interaction dominated rather than disorder dominated.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah, Tarun, go ahead.
Thank you for a very nice talk. I had a question about the the intuition you gave based on this spin charge separation, the wave function you wrote down. I guess similar wave functions will arise in higher dimensions also if there's a slave particle construction, which if it makes sense. So there are these ladder, there's series of papers by Donna Sheng, Martinez, Fisher, Colorado.
Yes.
So if I take those systems where, again, the wave function which is written is similar, broadly similar idea that you write, I don't know, some C as F1, F2, F3, and so it looks like a Schlatter determinant times some wave function of some bosons in some interesting state. So now if I had disorder in those systems, do you have any does this kind of, I mean, is there, do you get any insight into those systems based on the fact that you can?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a promising direction. I can't answer the question off the top of my head, having not looked at them directly, especially with disorder, but I'm certainly sympathetic to that way of thinking of the, you know, the kinds of strategy that you made mention. So I think that should be a promising thing to look at. Yeah, it's a good idea.
Okay, because there's this work by Anders Sandvik and collaborators where they argue random singlet pace in ring exchange models, which are similar looking.
Uh-huh.
They have, you might have seen this work. It's not an infinite random fixed point, but Z is not infinite. Mm-hmm. But it has random singlets at long distances.
And okay, so having the random, yeah, I agree. Having random singlets is not necessarily a hallmark of the infinite randomness fixed points, but right. The correlation functions behaving as 1/2D, I think is. I think that's a feature of the infinite randomness fixed point. So right. What do they find? Do they find some different behavior or?
I mean, Z is finite, but all I was saying was that those models have some similarities with this Fisher's the spin part of this
yes.
So I was wondering if you can carry over, if you combine those two works and use your you can argue that you'll flow to a phase where the metals, I mean the fermions, the charge is doing whatever it wants to was doing earlier, but the spins are that kind of state.
I mean, I think these are all good questions. I think what we need to understand is the competition with other magnetic phases, you know, I mean, not magnetic. I mean, other phases like the spin glass or a random singlet type behavior. Do you always find one or the other? What are the circumstances you find one versus the other? But the overall strategy, I agree with mm-hmm. what you're outlining. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
So Youngbak, go ahead.
great talk, Sri.
Hi.
Yeah, hey. So, sorry, I have a question about this interpretation in terms of Ogata-Shiba wave function.
Yeah.
So if I remember correctly, then what you're doing is you basically take out all the positions of the holes.
Right.
You take it out. Then
take it out, exactly.
In the remaining site, you consider basically Heisenberg model.
Correct.
So, but... In the end, if you're away from Hauke-Killing, then these holes are also moving around, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So the location of the local moment, so to speak, is dynamical, right? So yes. If I'm thinking about making a random singlet with another site, then it seems to me that your partner of the random singlet could be changing in principle, in time, I mean, depending on the motion of the holes. Of course, you may say, you know, holes are, you know, localized already, then of course, I don't know whether you can consider them as static objects, but if there are still some random hopping processes in the chain, then maybe that random singlet formation itself is a dynamical process.
Yeah, and you say that might affect the conductivity, say they are frequency-dependent response and so on because—
Right, so for example, you know, you only looked at the static correlator, I suppose, but
yeah.
If you start looking at like a dynamical correlator, I'm just wondering whether we actually see a different behavior compared to ordinary random singlet.
So I think at large you won't because the holes are free and the disorder in 1D is particularly bad and it causes freezing of the
basically holes are localized anyway.
Yeah, they're just frozen out and they just form boundaries for the definition of these spins. But the kind of thing you're talking about is probably hujely important for, say, phosphorus doped silicon, right?
Mm-hmm.
How to understand the three-dimensional system. And I have no idea how one does that. It seems like a fantastically mysterious problem.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so I don't have an answer.
Lanzini, go ahead.
Hi, Raghu. Thanks for a very stimulating talk. I just wanted to add that we looked at two dimensions and Hubbard model with disorder in two dimensions, and we found one interesting result.
Sorry, this is with Monte Carlo, right? With Richard Scalatar?
That as well as with and also with inhomogeneous mean field theory, not with Skeletor, that was with a student. Mm-hmm. And one thing that was always very puzzling was that at half filling, as you add disorder, mm-hmm. You have interactions and disorder competing, and it leads to sort of a quote unquote metallic phase. And the reason I say quote unquote is because we are on a finite system. So we definitely see the length, correlation lengths becoming very large. Whether or not it's truly metallic is yet to be seen. But the fact that you got some kind of a metallic phase, this is with potential disorder, which breaks particle hole symmetry. Mm-hmm. So you
in two dimensions.
So, in addition to Anderson localized phases and Mott insulators, there was also a kind of a metallic phase that developed at half filling, which was surprising. Mm-hmm. And I think coming to your picture of, the holes and the spins, which you described only away from half filling, there might be some such effective description even at half filling. So I would be very happy to discuss this in more detail.
Sure, I'd be happy to talk to you. I don't have anything to say off the top of my head, but I'd like to understand better what you're saying. Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
Interesting.
So Jan, please go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Sri. And I really did on your behalf, just to listen to it.
I hope you enjoyed your dinner.
Yeah, I enjoyed your talk. It was okay. It's really kind of follow up on Jung Beck's question. Mm-hmm. I guess you should know about what he once upon a time called string operators. It's based on Okada Shiba. Uh-huh. You know what I'm talking about? And then you can construct a correlator, right? That is basically effectively removing all the holes, making a squeezed lattice of the spin system. This is that ringing a bell? It's not very well known. I mean, it was picked up by the called Adam people, and we once upon a time invented it.
Okay.
And it didn't really spread because at that moment in time, not many people were working on these kind of problems. And then it was picked up by the called Adam people, mm-hmm. kind of an
Well, not well known to me doesn't mean not well known, period. So go ahead. Yeah. So,
right? Hong Cheng should know about him.
This is with his advisor, right?
Bottom line is, right, when you look at just the meat and potato Hubbert chain,
uh-huh.
and you look at the spin correlator, then you will find out that there's been spin correlators living at 2KF ordering wave factor, as usual. Mm-hmm. Right? And it decays this scaling exponent K sigma plus K rho.
Yes.
Then you look at this string operator, right, that just basically says when I see a hole, you remove that site and make a spin bond between adjacent spins. That's what it's doing. You can look it up. Hong Cheng, you should know about it.
Yeah.
Right? And then you basically get to see where the spin system is regardless how the holes are moving.
Okay.
I can imagine, and I'm not really sure, I didn't quite compute it so quickly, that when you look at it, it may shed light on the whole issue, right, of what these quasi-mobile holes are doing relative to the spin system. And you can just do it statically in DMRG. It all started actually with Ian McAuliffe. Long time ago, computing this is DMRG and proofing those universal.
Uh-huh.
If you wish, I can send you.
Please do. Sure.
Yeah.
I'm a total amateur in this field, so I'm learning lots of things and I'm enjoying this. So please send me whatever you have.
It'll be a pleasure.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions? Well, if not, let's thank Sri once again for a very nice talk.
Thank you.